The vast majority of American kids still dutifully line up for shots to prevent disease. Most kids get a series of vaccines before they're even allowed to attend public school. Resistance to the vaccine regime has certainly risen in recent years with a set of concerns about vaccine safety. We'll talk about a different aspect of vaccines today, the lingering question of how they work on the body. Turns out there's still some mystery there. Dr. Andrea Ferrante is with the University of Alaska Fairbanks, and he got a federal grant to go to the microscopic level and try to better understand vaccines. Dr. Ferrante, thanks for joining us on The Exchange.
My pleasure, Jeffrey. Thank you for calling me.
So it's surprising to hear that there's still some mystery about the workings of vaccines after all this time.
Yes, indeed. I would say that there is a lot to be understood yet, and we are just at the beginning.
But they've been working successfully for a long time is the weird thing. So we really haven't quite understood the mechanisms?
Yeah, so we know since experience of variolation first and then general exposure of the cowpox 200 years ago or more, that vaccine indeed work. And the idea is that if the immune system sees a weakened pathogen, such as a virus or a bacteria, can be trained to recognize it when the real one, the strong one, comes along. And we know that from experience, and we know that the vaccine have worked for the last 100 years or so. So there is no question about the efficacy of vaccine. But there are aspects at the molecular level and the cellular level that are still unclear to us. And the more we understand the minutiae, the details of this mechanism, we can design more efficient and better vaccine for everybody.
This is almost like a child saying why. I mean, we're delving further. It's like, well, vaccines do this, and somebody says why, and well, because they build up immunity. Why? So you're continuing to go deeper and deeper, it sounds like, with that question.
That is correct. You have to think that most of the molecular and cellular aspects of the immune response have become clear in the last, I would say, 30, 40 years. So although vaccine have been available for, as I said, you know, hundreds of years, I would say now, a century specifically, but how they work, that's becoming clear only in the last few decades. And, of course, better techniques that we have to evaluate molecular interactions and cellular interactions that allow us to also understand better what are the mechanisms behind vaccine activity.
So does this mean, Dr. Ferrante, that we're not entirely clear on how the immune system itself works?
Well, you know, it's a this is as big as the sky, I would say. So, you know, as the skies are infinite, and we discover a new galaxy and a new planet, it's the same thing with the immune system. Okay, we never, you know, I personally never end being surprised by, you know, things that happen in the immune system and that we didn't know before. So, as I said, in the recent time, we come to understand the molecular aspect of the immune response, and what we know is that there are specific cells that are called dendritic cells, and these cells are basically responsible for patrolling the periphery. So if, for instance, I injure myself and I cut myself, and therefore there is a wound, and expose my, you know, my skin to pathogen, bacteria, and viruses, then these dendritic cells are responsible for uptake the pathogens and the bacteria and the viruses. And they have the uncanny ability to degrade those pathogens in the smallest components that we call the peptides. Now, these peptides are the unit of information for the immune system. When other cells of the immune system see these peptides, they sort of understand there is something wrong going on, and they can prepare the response.
So it's almost as if the dendritic cells are sending out an alarm to the body by releasing the peptides.
That's exactly true. Now, there are other molecules that are the, as you, you know, put in the way you said, the alarm in signal, and these are called cytokines. And the cytokines are way to sort of tell the whole body that there is a an infection, and the one that we know, the probably the most common is the IL-1, which is also responsible, for instance, for fever, one of the effect of being infected. The dendritic cell basically give that information, exposing those bits of viruses or those bits of bacteria that we know as a peptide, and other cells of the immune system that we call the T cells. These are the ones that actually recognize the peptides, and they know that something is wrong, so they inform everybody else that we need to go at war.
Dr. Andrea Ferrante is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's at the Institute of Arctic Biology at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Just got a grant to look at a really molecular level for how vaccines work in the body. So we're getting quite a lesson here today. Your questions and comments are welcome. Some things maybe you've always wanted to know about body chemistry and the way that vaccines work. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. The cytokines, I remember hearing that in some diseases, particularly with the Spanish flu, they can sometimes overreact?
That's true. That is true. You have to think that the immune system response has to be very well balanced. And there are various way by which the system keeps everything in check. So when an individual is perfectly healthy, then it means that, upon recognition of a pathogen or, a virus or a bacterium, then the immune system response is really tailored to the pathogen and does everything that it needs to maintain the infection under control without going overboard. But there are situations in which these cytokines are synthesized and released in the body in a very large amount, to the point that we call it cytokine storm. And there are situations in which the intensity of the cytokine release and what they do on the immune system actually becomes more dangerous than the infection itself.
Wow, so the body really causes its own demise in some cases.
That is true. That is true. And that happened with the Spanish flu. That was one of the cases. And there are other situations where cytokine storms are actually the culprit for the pathology. Certain cases of tuberculosis, for instance, that's when the immune system goes a little bit crazy and it doesn't control itself. Or in other situations of autoimmunity or immunomediated diseases.
Wow, you have to work in two worlds here, in the sense that you're dealing with some fairly complicated terms and concepts within the body itself, and then have to be able to step back and deliver this to a general audience.
Sure. Going back to what we were saying, what we are trying to understand here in Fairbanks is a general concept. Okay, so how the dendritic cell is specifically selecting certain peptides out of the many many peptides that can be derived from a microbe. Microbes are made of multiple chemical components. Okay, there are carbohydrates, lipids, and proteins. And so, out of the proteins, many peptides can be made. But what we have found is that the response is usually focused only on few of them. And obviously, you can understand if we figure out what are the criteria by which those dendritic cells select only few of the peptides out of the many that can be derived from a microbe, then we can replicate that synthetically to design a synthetic vaccine. So that's the basis of it.
So the idea being to sort of train the body's immune system without having to introduce the actual pathogen?
That's exactly true. This is in general what happens with vaccine. Even the ones where, even where you have a live vaccine, but the live pathogen is always attenuated. So in itself, it has a very weak capability of producing disease. So and so the idea of vaccines is that, you know, you inject either a completely killed pathogen or something that still is alive but doesn't have any capacity to have a minimal residual capacity of inducing the disease. And what we are going now toward is identifying way to even eliminating the pathogen completely, and instead considering only those chemical pieces that are sufficient for the immune system to be trained to be able to recognize the actual one, but without introducing the pathogen at all.
Dr. Andrea Ferrante, again, our guest at the Jefferson Exchange. He is working on research into vaccines at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, but down to the molecular level, a bit apart from the ethical considerations that are raging in today's world. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So when I think about the fact that we're still not quite clear on exactly how vaccines work at the molecular level, how did the likes of Jonas Salk, for example, have any idea how to proceed with their vaccines?
Excuse me, can you repeat that again?
Dr. Salk with the polio vaccine. I mean, wonder how anybody who developed a vaccine years ago was able to do so, even today, not knowing quite what the molecular part of it is.
Well, most of it has been done in an empirical way. So we, as I said, since the time of Jenner, we knew that introducing a weakened or a killed pathogen or microbe that had still the component intact, that was sufficient to provide a training for the immune system. Basically, that's what we have been doing up to now. So the idea of once we recognize that there is an infection going on, or there is a specific pathogen, trying to isolate the pathogen and identify those elements of the microbe that can be responsible for the immunorecognition, it has always been a long process. Actually, historically. Making a vaccine, because it's been empirical, hasn't been as straightforward, and indeed it would take 10 up to 15 years to actually make a vaccine, you know. So the whole problem has been to identify in a sort of a fishing expedition those components of the microbe that would be able to trigger the immune response. But what we are moving toward now is actually starting from the genome of the microbe. Now we are able to identify all the possible proteins from the gene, so we don't have to culture or grow the microbe and do that at the lab bench. We can even do it on a computer. Down from the gene of the virus or the bacterium, we can work out what are the possible proteins of that microbe, and then we can predict which one are potentially able to promote an immune response, and that cuts a lot of the wet lab work. And then at that point, we can synthesize only those that we expect to be good promoter of the immune response and focus on them. So it is a more of an educated guess versus what used to be done, where once that we identify the pathogen causing a disease, we would have to culture it, identify, and isolate the single chemical component, see if those were able to trigger an immune response, and it would take a long time.
Well, it certainly seems like a safer way to go about things than what Dr. Jenner did 250 years ago or so, because he really took the risk of infecting people with cowpox in the hope of inoculating them against smallpox.
Yes, that's true. Well, they knew that cowpox itself was a mild disease. Basically, it wouldn't cause any disease in human. The challenge there was then to deliberately infect those individuals that had the cowpox administration with the smallpox, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, which on the one side is what makes that of gender approach more scientific, if you wish, because he actually designed an experiment where he showed that those who had the cowpox were free of smallpox disease. But obviously, there is a lot of ethical issue there, right?
That, yeah, not the kind of thing that would be allowed today.
Absolutely not.
No.
And we don't want to do that.
No. We're talking again to Dr. Andrea Ferrante at the University of Alaska Fairbanks about vaccines and how they work on the body at the molecular level. Let's take a call from Rose in Mount Shasta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi. I wanted to thank the doctor, the scientist, for talking about this issue. I've been very interested in it for years now. My daughter had a reaction years ago, and so I've been paying very close attention. And one of the concerns I have is the preservatives that they put in the vaccine, such as mercury and aluminum. And I know that Robert Kennedy Jr. had shown trace amounts to the Oregon legislators when they were set to vote for mandatory vaccines because of the measles outbreak. And once they saw the film, they dropped their support for mandatory. And so parents still have a choice in Oregon. And I'm grateful for that. I live in California, and unfortunately, parents, unless there's a medical exemption, can't have that right. So I just wondered if Dr. Ferrante is at all concerned with the mercury and aluminum, and I really encourage him to watch the film Trace Amounts.
All right. Thanks for the call, Rose. Appreciate that. Dr. Ferrante, it was bound to come up, the topic of the ethical part of vaccines.
Oh, yes, and I was expecting that someone would bring this up. And obviously, it's very important. It's very important that parents and everybody have an understanding of how vaccine work to make an educated decision about vaccines. So the problem of preservative, I understand that was the issue. Preservative and adjuvant, because the lady that just mentioned two different things. One was the preservative, which is the mercury, or the one we know as a thimerosal.
Mm-hmm.
And aluminum, which is not a preservative, but it's an adjuvant. So it's a different concept. And I will go with the adjuvant first, because it goes to the extra molecular aspect of how vaccine work. So I just mentioned these dendritic cells that are somehow the cells able to engulf or eat up the pathogens and then only present some of the peptides to the T cells for recognition. Now, these cells are actually helped in this activity if some of the receptors on their membrane is stimulated by what we call the adjuvants. So adjuvants are molecules that help to stimulate the body response. And aluminum, or alum, actually, because these are aluminum salts, these are one of the adjuvants that have been used in human vaccines. So this is one thing. It doesn't have to do with the preservation, with the preservatives. Preservative, on the other side, such as thimerosal, that has been used and is still used in a small amount as a preservative. And why is that? Well, because in certain cases, we need to have a way to prevent contaminations. And right now, vaccine that still contains thimerosal is the flu vaccine, when this is the multi-dose. Because in the multi-dose vaccine, what happens is that when you give the first shot, for instance, the needle can contaminate the vaccine preparation. Even if the needle is sterile, once that you puncture the vial, then you can bring some pathogen inside. So to make sure that the second and the third dose, the next dose of vaccine are still non-contaminated, then the thimerosal is taking care of that. But beside these few vaccines, then there is no thimerosal in vaccine preparation, and the the MMR, the mumps, measles, rubella vaccine, never contain any preservative or any mercury. So most of the criticisms surrounding vaccine administration and the possible connection of MMR with autism or other neurological diseases because of mercury, these are don't have any foundation because there was no mercury in such vaccines.
So it must be tricky, though, to try to focus on what you're working on here, which is to understand vaccines and the interaction with the body while this other controversy is still there around you.
In what regard?
Well, I just can imagine, you know, you have to be constantly aware of what's going on around you in the social context with people talking about vaccines in a way other than what you're working on.
Yes, that's true. But I think that I think this is the point. This is not in contrast. The better we understand how vaccines work, and the better job scientists can do in informing the audience, I think that is the way we take away some of the magic surrounding vaccine. This halo, and instead we give the factual science. That will certainly enable parents in general and people to understand that vaccine overall are safe, and therefore there is a reason to to keep vaccination going. Now that doesn't mean that any medical practice carries a little bit of risk, and there is no physician or no government body that is going to say that vaccine, as any other medical precaution is or medical activity is risk-free.
Mm-hmm.
But the benefits of vaccination outweighed the risk significantly.
All right. Dr. Andrea Ferrante is with the University of Alaska Fairbanks Institute of Arctobiology, studying how vaccines work on the body at the molecular level. Thanks so much for joining us today.
That was my pleasure. Thank you, Jeff.
All right. Take
Have
care.
Bye-bye.